Welcome everybody to a new quantum gravity seminar. So today we have a guest from Europe. It's Ilkka Mäkinen. And so Ilkka, I was an undergrad in Finland. And then he did his PhD in Warsaw with Professor Lewandowski. And now he's a postdoc in Warsaw. He has been working on several aspects of canonical quantum gravity and the Hamiltonian constraint. And today is going to tell us about the relationship between quantum reduced loop gravity and the full quantum gravity theory. So as usual, let's try to keep questions for the end, only if you really need to ask some clarification during the seminar. And then we start with the postdocs and students, and then we'll continue with everyone else with questions at the end. Okay, so I'll let Ilkka take the stage. Please.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you all for coming. And also many thanks to the organizers for inviting me. Because it's a pleasure to have a chance to talk about my work here in this seminar, even in spite of these strange times. Okay. So as I'm sure all of you know, loop quantum gravity is one of the main candidates for a quantum theory of gravity. And from the mathematical point of view, loop quantum gravity is founded on extremely solid foundations. Everything is very proper and rigorous on the mathematical side. And also on the conceptual side, at least in my opinion, these ideas on which the theory is based are very nice. Though, of course, this is a question where different people might well have different opinions. However, one of the big challenges of the theory is on the practical side. Because it tends to happen that whenever you try to do some actual concrete calculations about physics in the theory, then the technical complications that you have to deal with are usually extremely challenging. And indeed, even now, after more than 30 years have now passed since the birth of the theory, there are still very few actual calculations about physics that would have been done in the full theory. And this state of affairs naturally has motivated people to look for different kinds of simplified approaches which they could use to sort of study the physical content of the theory. And among these approaches are, for example, different kinds of symmetry-reduced models, which are based on reducing the number of degrees of freedom in the classical theory and then studying the quantum theory of this reduced phase space. So in this class of models, obviously the most famous one is loop quantum cosmology. And then there are also, for example, some models of spherical symmetry that are in the same spirit. Then the one that I want to focus on in today's talk is quantum reduced loop gravity, which so there the assumption on which the model is based is a particular kind of gauge fixing, which is performed in the quantum theory. And this I will, of course, explain in more detail later. And then there are also other approaches, for example, this so-called effective dynamics program that people have been recently working on. And there even might be some more that may have escaped my mind when I was preparing this slide. Okay, so this quantum reduced loop gravity, which is sort of the topic of my talk, is one of these simplified models of loop quantum gravity. It was proposed by Alessi and Gianfrani like 7 or 8 years ago. And this model is based on a gauge fixing in the quantum level to a diagonal densitized triad field. And therefore this, even though this was initially motivated most of all as an attempt to study the cosmological sector of loop quantum gravity, this model is actually much more general, and at least in principle you can use it to give a quantum description of any spacetime which is classically described by a diagonal spatial metric. And indeed, this quantum reduced formalism has recently been extended also to the spherically symmetric case with the intention of applying it to study the physics of black holes. And this extension to spherical symmetry, this actually was done by Daniele together with some collaborators. So from the technical point of view, the characteristic feature, and I would even say a very attractive feature of this quantum reduced model, is the considerable simplicity of its operators in comparison with the corresponding operators in full loop quantum gravity. A good example of this is the volume operator, which is diagonal in the quantum reduced model on the natural basis states of the reduced Hilbert space. And this you can compare with what the situation is in the full theory, where we even don't have an explicit analytical expression for the matrix elements of the volume operator, except in some certain simple special cases. Okay, so far the work that has been performed on this quantum reduced model is it has mostly focused on the physical and phenomenological applications of the model. And in particular, there has not been much research on the relation between the quantum reduced model and the full theory of loop quantum gravity. And in this talk, I will address a particular aspect of this relation, namely I'll clarify how these remarkably simple operators of the quantum reduced model are related to the operators of the full theory. So this will be the main result that I'm going to present today. However, before getting there, I will start by giving an extremely brief introduction to or a review of the basic kinematical structure of loop quantum gravity. And then after this, I'll give an equally brief review of the quantum reduced model. And then after this, the remainder of the talk will I'll discuss this issue of the operators. So the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity is the space of so-called cylindrical functions. And a cylindrical function is a function like this, so it is labeled by a graph gamma, which has some number of edges e1 to en. And then here, as arguments of the function, there is an SU2 group element for each edge of the graph. And these group elements originate classically from holonomies of the Ostekar connection, and for this reason we usually call them holonomies also in the quantum theory. And then for the purposes of this talk, about the only thing you need to know about this space of cylindrical functions is that a basis in this space is given by these functions which are right here, which basically have an SU2 representation matrix for each edge of the graph. So any cylindrical function that you have, it can be expanded in terms of these functions here. And these here are the basic kinematical states, and then the elementary operators of the theory are the so-called holonomy and flux operators. And here on the bottom of the slide, I define the holonomy operator, so it just simply acts by multiplication on a cylindrical function. And then the basic tool for computing the action of this operator is this Clebsch-Gordan series of SU2, which tells you how to reduce this product of two representation matrices to a sum of terms where there is only one matrix element of the D matrix. And these C's here, of course, they are the normal Clebsch-Gordan coefficients of SU2. Okay, so then on the next slide here, I'll define the flux operator. So here it is convenient to start by first defining this sort of auxiliary operator J. So this J operator carries an SU2 vector index I and is also labeled by a point V and an edge E such that this V is either the beginning point or ending point of the edge. And then depending on whether it is the beginning point or the ending point, then the J operator acts as a left invariant or a right invariant SU2 vector field, and it acts on this holonomy here that coincides with the edge labeling the operator here. And then from this definition here, you can in particular figure out how this operator acts on the holonomy, and then these two equations are what you will find. So basically the J, depending on whether it acts on the beginning point or the ending point, it inserts this SU2 generator on the appropriate side of the holonomy matrix. And then given this operator J, the flux operator can be expressed in the way that I wrote here on the bottom of the slide. But there is this double sum here, which maybe looks a little strange, but this is basically a sum of all the intersections that this graph has with the surface on which the flux operator is defined. And then up to some numerical factors here, there is basically just a J operator at each of the intersections. And this here concludes my very minimal review of loop quantum gravity. Of course, if I was giving an introduction to loop quantum gravity here, I would go on to define the spaces of gauge invariant and diffeomorphism invariant states and so on. But for the purposes of this talk here, there's no need to go there because these spaces will not play any role here.
There's a question by Lee.
Sure.
I have you can ignore this if you want. This is a very technical question about the normalization or regularization. Sure. Flux operator is not defined in any way as a functional of a quantization of a frame field or a product of frame fields at points in the manifold. It knows that there is an edge and it knows that there is an end of an edge, which is not that the classical operators know anything.
Okay. Okay, so I may have spoke badly when I said that I define the flux operator here. Of course, this operator E here, this indeed defined as a quantization of the classical flux of E through a surface, and then here I'm just writing what the final result of the quantization is.
Oh, that's not what I wanted you to say. What I wanted you to say is that you're very excited and willing to break from the chokehold of having to...
I see.
Anyway, thank you. I understand.
Okay, so let me then move on to introduce the model of quantum reduced loop gravity. So also here I will describe the Hilbert space of the model and then the elementary operators on this space. So here this Hilbert space of the quantum reduced model is constructed by looking for the weak solutions of certain, I might call them, reduction constraints, which are meant to implement the gauge fixing in the quantum theory to the diagonal triad field. And this Hilbert space that comes out of this procedure is a proper subspace of the kinematical Hilbert space of the full theory. And these basis states that span the reduced Hilbert space, they are cylindrical functions of the form that I showed earlier, and they are specified by these three requirements here. So we first of all assume that there is some background coordinate system, and we demand that the edges of the graph are aligned along the x, y, and z axis of this coordinate system. And secondly, we must assume that the spin quantum number carried by each edge of the graph is larger. And then finally, the representation matrix that belongs to each edge is of the type where the magnetic indices are either maximal or minimal with respect to the direction of the edge. And then here on the next slide, I will explain more precisely what this maximal or minimal with respect to the direction of the edge means. So first I here introduce some notation. So I denote by this, so here I is x, y, or z. I denote like this the states that diagonalize the square of angular momentum and the I component with the usual eigenvalues. And then I introduce this notation for the SU2 representation matrices in the basis defined by these states here. And then with these definitions, I can say that these so-called reduced spin network states, even though these are not really spin network states in the meaning that this word usually has in loop quantum gravity. But anyway, these states which span the reduced Hilbert space have this form here. So depending on whether the edge E is in the direction x, y, or z, then this matrix here is in the basis x, y, or z. And then this sigma here is a sign. It's either plus one or minus one, and then the magnetic indices are either equal to plus j or minus j. And here I might make a comment about this state, namely that there are no intertwiners of any kind involved in it, even though in the earlier papers on the quantum reduced model, these states are sometimes defined by inserting some what they call reduced intertwiners. at the nodes of the graph. However, these reduced intertwiners are simply constant complex numbers multiplying these basis states and then being just constant numbers, they can't possibly carry any physically meaningful information, so then it's just best to drop them and make the definition of these reduced states a little simpler. And then I make here another technical remark, namely that this relation here, which relates the matrix elements of the inverse matrix to the matrix elements of the non-inverse matrix, this implies that I can somewhat reduce the number of states that I need to consider here. So I can either take one fixed orientation of the graph and allow both values of the sine factor sigma, or I can keep track of the orientation of each edge, and if I do that, I can set every sigma to plus one, because if some sigma were minus one, then this relation shows that I can reverse the orientation of the edge, and by this I'll make sigma from minus to plus. And this I'm just saying because then when I come to discuss the operators, it is more convenient to take this second point of view, because then you only need to consider the action of each operator on this matrix of the type JJ, and when we don't have to separately consider the case minus J minus J. Okay, so these are the basic states of the quantum reduced model, and then here I introduce the elementary operators, so the reduced holonomy and flux operators. And these reduced holonomy and flux, they are normally introduced in the literature of the quantum reduced model as projections of the operators of the full theory down to the reduced Hilbert space. And then first I have here the holonomy operator. So since you think of this as being projected, then it happens that also the indices of the holonomy operator must be equal to the maximal or the minimal value. And then we have this so-called reduced recoupling rule, which shows how this reduced holonomy operator acts on a state like this. And this is indeed very simple. This is basically the multiplication law of U1. You simply add, or in the second case, you subtract the labels here. And then this reduced flux operator is only defined for surfaces which are dual to the coordinate directions of this background coordinate system. So we have these surfaces SI such that the background coordinate XI is constant on the surface. And then with the surface restricted like this, then the reduced flux operator simply acts diagonally. So in the first case where all of these labels agree with each other, it just picks off this magnetic number, and then if either the surface is wrongly or if it's aligned differently with respect to the edge, or if the index of the flux operator doesn't agree with this here, then simply this gives zero. And because the reduced flux operator is diagonal, then also the operators that you construct out of the flux operator, in particular the volume operator, they are extremely simple in the quantum reduced model compared to how the case is in the full theory. Okay, so this all that I had to say about the basic structure of the quantum reduced model, and I now move on to the main part of the talk, where I will discuss the relation between these simple reduced operators and the proper operators of full loop quantum gravity. And this work that I present here, it is in this paper which I have recently posted on archive. And the main claim which I will make here is that these so-called reduced operators are simply the actual operators of the full theory acting on states in the reduced Hilbert space. And this is the case even if the reduced operators are extremely simple, and even though they were at first introduced as projections of the full operators down to the Hilbert space of the quantum reduced model. So the somewhat more precise statement is that if we take an operator of the full theory and we act on a state in the reduced Hilbert space, then the term of leading order in J agrees with the action of the reduced operator. Then there are generally also some lower order terms. However, if we recall that these states in the reduced Hilbert space are required to carry large spins on their edges, then it's well justified to keep just the leading term, and when we can argue that these lower terms can be ignored. And in some cases, I should say that this approach doesn't exactly reproduce the reduced operator in the form that it has been claimed to have in the papers of the quantum reduced model. And the most notable difference will be in the case of the holonomy operator, where we will discover a slightly different version of the reduced holonomy operator.
There is Lee who has a question again.
Sure.
Yes, Lee? Lee, we don't hear you. You can unmute yourself.
Sorry. Are you claiming that there is in the whole dynamical theory a large J limit which is uniform and which we could work with?
No, at this stage, I wouldn't claim dynamical theory. This work that I present here is purely kinematical, and I think there is still some work to be done before we can properly understand the dynamics of this reduced model.
Okay, but is that your intuition?
No, I wouldn't say that I have any reasonable intuition of what is going to happen. Even this kinematical result which I'm going to present here, it came as somewhat of a surprise to me, and just based on intuition alone, I could not have anticipated that this is going to happen, what I am presenting here.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe to comment on that. So the statement is that if you can build the Hamiltonian constraint out of fluxes and holonomies, you can act on these kinematical states, for instance, if you were interested in obtaining some effective Hamiltonian. And the action of this dynamical Hamiltonian constraint would be the same action, basically, that you have on the reduced states would be, at the leading order, the same action that you had on the full theory.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yes.
So in that sense, you can implement dynamics in the reduced Hilbert, quantum-reduced Hilbert space by, if you're only interested in the effective Hamiltonian, for instance. I'm not sure if that was the question, Lee, but...
Yes, that is the question. The question is both a physical question. What if there is such a limit? And I know you're not willing to endorse that. What is the physical meaning of it? What's its significance? And the second is, does it open the door to being able to compute a lot more things?
No, certainly if we are talking about computing things, then certainly in the quantum reduced framework, you can compute many things which would be practically impossible in the full theory. But then these calculations, they of course, there already have been performed some calculations in this reduced model. So from that point of view, I'm not really presenting here anything new. And I would say that the significance of this result is that it will better justify these reduced calculations from the point of view of the full theory. Because previously it was not very clear how much of this reduced framework is well justified and how much of it is simply postulated or just guessed.
Okay, but that's still very interesting.
Okay, so then for the remainder of this talk, I will spend my time on justifying this claim that I make here. And I will demonstrate this just by direct calculation. I will take an operator such as holonomy or flux or volume, and I will take a state from the reduced Hilbert space, and then I will see what the action of the operator gives. And I'll start by discussing the holonomy operator. And here the discussion consists first of two examples and then of considering the general case. Because these two examples, they first of all, they will show the mechanism by which the reduced holonomy operator comes out of the full holonomy operator. And then they will also show us, or they will allow us to anticipate what the result will be in the general case, since it will be slightly different from what has been previously considered as a reduced holonomy operator in the literature. Okay, so here on this slide, I have the first example, which is a holonomy operator carrying spin 1/2. And the action of this operator on this reduced, so I call this state here reduced holonomy, this one where the magnetic indices are maximal. So then it just by general principles, it gives this. And now I can just go case by case, since for this spin 1/2 indices A and B, there's only two possible values, plus half and minus half, which I also call plus and minus here. So in the case plus plus, the sum actually has only one term, and then you immediately get this, and there is not much to calculate. So for the plus plus component, we exactly get the reduced recoupling rule that I previously showed. Then the case minus minus is a little less trivial. So in this case, you get both terms from the sum. So here the total spin can be either j minus half or j plus half. And in the case minus minus, you actually get both of them. And then at first, it seems that this doesn't have much to do with the reduced holonomy operator, because here in the second term, we have a holonomy which is of the proper form. But then there's also the first term where the magnetic indices are not maximal and they also are not minimal. But if we put here the explicit values of this Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, then this is what we get on the next line. So we see that if J is large, then the coefficient of the good term is approximately 1, and the coefficient of the bad term is of order 1 over J. So even in this case, even though we don't exactly get the nice multiplication law of the reduced holonomy, we get it up to a term of order 1 over J. Okay, and then in the case where one index is plus and the other index is minus, then there's no chance to get this reduced form of the holonomy. However, here in this case, one of these coefficients is basically the square root of this, so it's of order 1 over square root of j. The other coefficient is 1, so in this plus minus case, the entire result is of lower order in J compared to the leading term in this result here and this result here. But of course, this here, it's only of order 1 over square root of J, so it's not as small as the correction term is here. But anyway, so what we learned from all this, that if we only keep the terms of order 1 and drop all these smaller correction terms, then we get the reduced recoupling theorem for the reduced holonomy operator just by acting with the holonomy operator of the full theory on this state here. Okay, then before going to the general case, I go through another example where the holonomy operator carries spin 1, because in this case we will discover a new feature which was not present in the first example. So here, just as in the previous example, you find that if the indices are 1, 1, you immediately get the result that we are looking for. If the indices are minus, minus, then we again get the reduced multiplication law up to a correction. And then if the indices are different from each other, then we also get that the entire result is of lower order in J. And here the new feature happens in the case that both indices are equal to 0. So in this case, we again get two terms. One is of the good form, one is not of the good form. And then again, the good term has a coefficient of order 1. The bad term has a coefficient of order 1 over J. So we find also for the 0, 0 component of the holonomy operator this result here. So also the 0, 0 component acts properly in the way that so-called reduced operator should act, and these different from the usual formulation of the quantum reduced model, where one also assumes that the index of the holonomy operator must be maximal or minimal. So it, in this spin one case, you would only have one, one, and minus one, minus one, but this zero, zero component would not be considered as a valid operator in the usual formulation of this model. Okay, and I then go to the general case. So, based on these two examples that I discussed, we expect to find in the general case that every diagonal component of the holonomy operator acts in the proper reduced way. And of course, here I since this J of the state is assumed to be large, I must then assume that the spin carried by the holonomy operator is small compared with the spin of the state. Because if S and J were both of the same order of magnitude, then there would be the danger that the action of the holonomy operator doesn't preserve the requirement that J has to be larger. Okay, and then under this assumption that S is small compared to J, I indeed find that this is the case. And then to show that this claim is true, I can just write down the general form of this result, and here I have picked out the term which is of the form that I want, and then here in this sum here I have all the rest of the terms. So now to prove the result, it is now enough to show that this coefficient here is of order one in the under the assumption of large J and S small relative to J. But then this important coefficient is given by this explicit expression here, which you can then simply expand in powers of 1 over J, and then it indeed comes out that the leading term is 1. And then if this coefficient is approximately 1, then this completeness relation of the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient guarantees that the remaining coefficients which appear here are of lower order in J. And in this way, we find that in this whole sum here, only the first term has a coefficient of order 1 and all the other coefficients are small. And then in the same way, you can discuss the case when a non-diagonal component of holonomy acts on this state, and then you find as before that this entire result is small compared to the term of order 1 here. So here I'll summarize what we learned from all these calculations for the holonomy operator. We showed that when the holonomy operator of the full theory acts on this state here, then every diagonal component of the operator behaves according to this multiplication law here, which looks very much like the multiplication law of the reduced holonomy operator. And then, of course, the difference is that in the usual formulation of the reduced model, you would also assume that here M has to be either S or minus S. And this is the main difference that we find in the case of the holonomy operator, that every diagonal component acts in a way that preserves the reduced form of the state at leading order in J. Okay, so let me then move on to the other operators. So I will then, after holonomy, I will discuss the flux operator. And then to discuss the flux operator, I'll have to start by discussing this auxiliary operator J. So here I make a calculation of what happens when J acts on this reduced state. And for concreteness, I assume that the edge is in the Z direction and this point V is the beginning point of the edge. And in this case, the J operator acts like this. But then I can now simply insert the explicit form of these matrix elements of the generators. And then if I do that, I find that the Z component of the operator acts diagonally. So it simply picks the value of the magnetic index. And this, of course, this is the Z component because I assume that the edge is aligned along direction Z. Then the X and Y components are not diagonal, but they are again of lower order because here this coefficient is of order square root of J compared to here the eigenvalue being J. And of course here, even in the limit of large J, since this is still square root of J, it would be too much to say that you can simply ignore this. However, what this result means that if you have some operator where all the components of J appear, for example, the volume operator, which I'll discover, I'll discuss the volume operator in a moment, then the term of highest order comes from these components that act diagonally, and then these non-diagonal components will give terms of lower order in J. And then, of course, if this edge is aligned in some other direction, then we find that this J operator whose index matches with the direction of the edge is diagonal and gives the eigenvalue J. And rather it gives plus or minus depending on whether this is the endpoint or the beginning point of the edge. And then the other components are of order square root of J only. Okay, so then the flux operator. So for the flux operator, there are two cases to consider. We can either have that the surface of the flux operator intersects the edge at one of the endpoints of the edge. And in this case, we find that the flux operator acts more or less as the reduced flux operator, namely in the case that all the labels match with each other, the action is diagonal. And then if some of the labels do not match each other, then we either get something of order square root of J, or if the surface doesn't properly match with the edge, then we simply get zero. And then the other case is if the intersection between the surface and the edge is at an interior point of the edge. So in this case, this...
Sorry, I have a question.
Yes.
Can you explain what is the index K on E?
what is the index K?
Well, you have an index K on E and on S. What do they mean?
In this setup which I'm discussing here, this all these I, K, and L, these are either they take the values X, Y, or Z. So the this K here is properly the SU2 index of the flux operator. But then here I'm working in the normal basis where this index is either X, Y, or Z. So here we have somehow.
What is the I of the S? Sorry. Whether I is equal to K. So usually we don't. I mean, is SI intersecting? Yeah.
I don't know. This I, which labels the surface, it simply tells how the surface is aligned. So this SI is a surface which is dual to the I-axis of this background coordinate system. So in other
words, usually in loop curvity, there's no way we can tell. All we have is an edge and we have a transverse surface. And it is the flux that tells us whether it's aligned along X or along Y or along Z. So you can't choose the orientation of S independently of E. It's not an option.
Yes, but this. So here I'm still I'm in the setup of the quantum reduced model where we assume that we have some background coordinate system that defines some chosen directions in space. So from the point of view of the full theory, I'm still in the kinematical Hilbert space. I've not done anything with.
Yeah, but even from the point of view of the full theory, if at a vertex you choose the flux, let's say, to be a line along J, right? When you choose your state JJ or JM, it's essentially telling you that the flux is a line along the third direction that you have chosen in your group. And if all the flux are aligned along the third direction, there cannot be any volume at the vertex. So usually that's why you cannot have a collection of flux that are all diagonal in the same common diagonal basis, because such geometry would be completely degenerate.
No, but these are not, they are diagonal only at leading order in J.
Even at leading order, it doesn't matter because your reduced state that you were taking in the beginning, it's a reduced state, which is very nice, but it's a completely degenerate geometry reduced state. You see, if all the flux are aligned to one direction, then you cannot create a volume around a collection.
They are not all aligned in one direction.
No, they are, because you choose that EI is only, if they are not aligned, then you have to make a rotation between one edge and the other. So you have to change the basis. You see here, you have chosen a common reference axis of rotation, and then you're aligning all the flux to that common axis. If you want to get volume, you would have to have autonomies on x-axis and y-axis. And for that,
exactly.
For that, it would mean that you would have extra autonomies between one and the other.
No, but this exactly like you said in your last sentence. So here this holonomy has also this label I, which is X, Y, or Z according to the direction of the edge E. And then this.
Yeah, but then, okay, so you could do that, but then the Gauss law conservation needs to, then you cannot take the kinematical states you were taking in the beginning as something that would even satisfy the Gauss law, you see?
Yeah, certainly they don't satisfy the Gauss law, at least not as as an exact equation.
Well, even in the larger limit, they won't satisfy the Gauss law, I promise.
Yeah, possibly not, but this I... certainly, in the future, I would better like to understand what role gauge invariance plays in this quantum reduced model. But for now, my point of view has sort of been that since the starting point of the model is a gauge fixing to a diagonal metric, which is described by a diagonal triad. Of course, if you fix the triad to be diagonal, then you fix the gauge transformations which are described by the Gauss law. And for this reason, I never found it very worrying that these reduced states are not gauge invariant.
I mean, otherwise you would have to, when you write this the J index, it should depend on the direction I, right? So the J1 is not the same as the J2.
But that
creates really, it opens another cans of worms, right? It's like, you cannot use the action of the autonomy you were using, which referred to common, anyway. Okay.
I can. So the calculation that I showed for the holonomy operator, this does the for convenience, I was doing it in the normal basis where the Z component is diagonal. But of course the same, I mean, it maybe depends on some, like you have to properly define how you choose the states that diagonalize the I component, because there might be many different ways of choosing them. But if you choose them in a good way, then the same calculation also works if you multiply two holonomies which are written in the X basis or two holonomies that are written in the Y basis.
Yeah, as long as you're aligned. But if you want to go around the corner and then go from X to Y, then, you know. That is, if you want to compute loops or curvature from the solenoid, you cannot assume that they're all in the same JJ basis, in some sense. You'll have to use the off-diagonal elements.
So in principle, yes, I have all the elements. However, if I'm only looking for the leading term in J, then this comes from the terms where each. So it comes from the terms where all the components of the holonomy are diagonal with respect to the proper basis. I mean the basis that corresponds to the direction of each edge.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so it seems that I don't have very much time left, so let me just briefly go through the remaining results that I have. So I here the calculation of how the volume operator acts on this reduced node. So if we take the volume operator and we simply act on this state here, which is the reduced state associated with this six-valent node, then we find that there's a leading term which is of order j to third, and this leading term is simply diagonal on this state. And then again, the terms which are not diagonal, they are smaller by one power of j. So I suppose it is also, since here the coefficient of the diagonal term is certainly not zero in general, I suppose this also demonstrates that this reduced state describes a geometry which is not diagonal, since the volume is not zero. Okay, and
what would be the intertwining condition? Is it that J1 plus J4 is equal to zero? Or is it that J1 is equal to J4?
Yes, so if J1 is equal to J4 and the same for the other two pairs of edges, then this satisfies the Gauss law up to terms of lower order in J. Of course, if you want the Gauss law to be exactly satisfied, then I don't think there's any condition you can put on the spins that will make it happen. But if it's a condition that you set, then it will be satisfied at leading order.
Okay.
And then on the next slide, I simply show here the actual volume operator is the square root of this operator I considered here. So here I simply show how you can justify that in the previous equation you can simply take the square root of the leading term, and this gives you the leading term in the action of the volume. And then here I have a slide about the Hamiltonian, which is basically the Euclidean part of Thiemann's Hamiltonian in this graph preserving regularization that people have previously used in the quantum reduced framework. So here I don't have any new exciting statement to make. I simply confirm that in this approach which I'm presenting here, from the leading term in the action of this operator, you simply recover the reduced Hamiltonian which people have previously constructed in their papers of the quantum reduced model. Okay, and then I finally come to my conclusions. So the main statement that I was making in this talk is that even though these reduced operators of the quantum reduced model are extremely simple, they are nevertheless just the operators of the full theory acting on states in the reduced Hilbert space. And more precisely, the statement is that when you act with a full operator on the state in the reduced space, then the term of leading order in J gives you the action of the reduced operator. And then I remind you again that in the reduced model, all the J's labeling the state are assumed to be large, so then it's well justified to say that you can just keep the leading term and discard the rest. And alternatively, if someone still prefers to think that the reduced operators are the operators of the full theory projected, to the reduced Hilbert space, then this result shows that the terms which are preserved by the projection are large, and the terms which are removed by the projection are of smaller order in J compared to the ones that were preserved. So this, at least in my view, the main significance of this result is that it kind of clarifies the foundations of this quantum reduced model and how this model is related with the full theory. Because here you can make the statement that now the only genuine technical assumption of the quantum reduced model is the structure of the reduced Hilbert space. And if we somehow consider that this reduced Hilbert space is given, then you get this simple reduced operator simply by applying the operators of the full theory to the reduced states, and you don't need to introduce any additional assumptions there. The only assumption is that you just keep the term of leading order in J. And then also for someone who has a general interest in loop quantum gravity but doesn't care about the quantum reduced model at all, I can still offer a different interpretation of the result, namely that I have shown that there exists a particular subspace of the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity such that this space is preserved by the basic operators of the theory, and these basic operators act in this space in a very simple way. And again, this statement is true, of course, up to neglecting subleading terms in J. Okay, so in the case of the holonomy operator, I found this modified version of the reduced holonomy operator. And the modification was that every diagonal component of the holonomy operator, and not only the ones where the magnetic indices are maximal or minimal, acts properly as a reduced operator. Of course, if the holonomy operator carries spin 1/2, then there's no difference between the original version of the reduced holonomy operator and the modified one. And therefore, if one wanted to investigate which version of the holonomy operator is correct, could simply repeat some calculation which has already been done in the quantum reduced model. For example, the semi-classical analysis of the Hamiltonian, but this time you would let the loop of the Hamiltonian carry a spin other than 1/2. And then I suppose you would find that only one version of the holonomy operator and not both of them would give the proper semi-classical limit. And this, I've of course not done this yet, but I'm just suggesting this here as something that I would like to do. Oh, and I'm already out of time by quite a lot, so let me just conclude and say that this what I showed here in this talk today, I think that this very nicely clarifies the relation between quantum reduced loop gravity and the full theory as far as the operators of the two theories are concerned. But of course, it would also be good to understand this reduced Hilbert space in a more systematic way from the point of view of the full theory. And this is also something that I would like to understand better in the future. Okay, and this was all that I had to say. Thank you very much for your attention.
All right, thank you, Rika. Okay, so questions? I see we don't have many students, so we can just, whoever has a question can ask. Actually, I wanted to ask one thing. So in the case, for instance, the black hole, we consider also states in which you don't only have maximum, and minimum, but also you can have mixed terms in which you have maximum one side and minimum the other.
I see.
Do you have any idea how that would affect this result?
I looked at it very briefly. I think so. Of course, what happens with the flux operator is not very different from what happened here, and the holonomy operator is the one that you would need to figure out. And I looked at it some time ago in the case that the holonomy has been 1/2, and I think that in that case, it is that so if you act on a state which has j minus j, then the plus minus and minus plus components of the holonomy operator act as reduced operators, while the plus plus and minus minus component give a lower order term as a result.
Okay, so it still goes through, basically, you're saying.
In the spin 1/2 case, at least. But I suppose that if you did it in the general case, there's a high chance that it also goes through there.
Okay.
So it seems to me that in the case that you also have J minus J and minus JJ as the magnetic indices, then this reduced space sort of splits into two subspaces. One is the one with plus plus and minus minus, then the other is plus minus and minus plus. And then the holonomy operator simply preserves these two subspaces and doesn't mix them with each other.
Okay.
And of course the flux operator doesn't mix them either, because simply it doesn't change the value of J.
Okay, that's good to know.
I have a question. How would you put perturbation around that?
Oh, sorry, can you repeat? I didn't.
Well, I mean, here it's a very rigid state, right? Where all the x axes are aligned along each other. But if you put a priori, there's no reason that the x axes from point to point are the same x axes. In a dynamical space-time. So how would you make a perturbation? How would you realize a perturbation?
There's something to think about in the future. I've not really thought about this question at all. Of course, this structure with the, as you say, rigid X, Y, and Z axis, this sort of comes because, as I said, this was initially meant as a model of cosmology, where you sort of you either have one scale factor or you have three different scale factors. But in that situation, it's very natural to have these rigid axes. But how to go beyond that to something more general, I don't really know how to do it at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
So do we have other questions from? Okay, if not, then let's thank Ilka again.